And our special guest tonight, Michael Cremo. We'll be back with Michael in a moment. Some of the things that he has written about in his first book, Forbidden Archaeology, absolutely stunning. We'll talk about that and human devolution on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with our guest, Michael Cremo. Michael, where do you think we came from?
Well, to put it very simply, we did not come up from matter on this planet, as most scientists now tell us. Rather, we've come from a higher level of the cosmos, a level dominated by pure consciousness or spirit.
Or one would say God.
Yes, I think if we actually look at consciousness, say I'm conscious, you're conscious, every one of our listeners out there is conscious, otherwise we wouldn't be in this position. So one thing we notice about consciousness, it's individual, it's personal. Each of us has our own personal consciousness. And to me, that suggests that the source of all conscious beings is also individual and personal. Now, you can call that God if you like. And it seems to me what's really happened is if we give up our connection with the source of all conscious beings, then we've got to have some place to go. And here, where we are now, that's the place. This is the place for us to act out our fantasies that we ourselves are gods, that we ourselves are meant to control and dominate everything. And that's why you see so much competition in the world. You've got so many people thinking that they are number one, either individually or collectively. And it breeds a lot of conflict in the world, as we see.
And a lot of greed and everything else.
Absolutely.
Do you believe that there's extraterrestrial life that has gone through then this same kind of devolution as we have, which means then that they didn't come from matter, they came from this spiritual or other realm?
Here's how I think it works. There is that topmost level of pure consciousness or spirit. And it's possible for all conscious selves to remain there if they want to. However, each conscious self has free will. If it misuses its free will, it descends into the lower levels of the cosmos. Now, some conscious selves, some spirits, they may descend to the level of what I call the mind element. And there, the conscious self may become covered by the subtle mental energies, and such conscious selves may exist on that level as astral beings, angels, gods, goddesses, whatever. As I said, people down through history have had different names for these types of beings, and I think they also are reflected in the modern UFO alien abduction phenomenon, because you've got two groups of researchers in that field. One tends to think that they are simply beings like us, material beings making use of material spacecraft, you know, from some other place on our level of the cosmos. However, there's another group of researchers, an example being John Mack, the psychiatrist from Harvard
right.
University.
God rest his soul.
Right. I actually met him at a Crop Circle conference in England the same year that he left this world as a result of that horrible
accident
yeah. or whatever that happened.
Yeah, he got hit by some drunk driver or something.
Right.
Supposedly.
So he had, you know, heard about, you know, this alien abduction, you know, phenomenon. And he began investigating it as a psychiatrist, and he found the people that were reporting these things, they weren't insane, they weren't neurotic or psychotic, they were perfectly normal human beings who were displaying the same sorts of symptoms that, say, soldiers who had been involved in a battle,
mm-hmm.
or humans, that ordinary people who had been involved in some crime had been attacked or something. In other words, they were displaying post-traumatic stress symptoms. And he determined, well, the phenomenon appears to be genuine, and that got him in a lot of trouble with his colleagues at Harvard who tried to get him removed from his position. You know, they convened an academic court to try to have him removed, but he successfully fought that. And in his book, Passport to the Cosmos, he said it appears ever more likely that we exist in a multi-level cosmos, you know, inhabited by different sorts of beings existing on the different levels, which I agree with 100%. That's exactly what I'm saying. And he himself admitted it's not an idea that's an original with him or me or anybody else. It's the common heritage of humankind, you know, down through history, that's the picture of reality that we have. So there are these beings that exist on that level. It's possible to come down to the further level that we now exist in, the level of the grosser material elements, where we have a covering not only of mind but of matter. So if we, you know, want to ask the question, well, where did we all come from? Well, I think we all came from that topmost level of pure consciousness or spirit, and according to our different destinies and desires, we've come down to different levels. As I said, there are some souls who are existing at that level of the subtle mental energies, and there are some of us who have come down to this level of gross matter, but it's possible to reverse the process. You know, there's a process of spiritual re-evolution. And I think every tradition has some kind of process of prayer, meditation, or yoga that is meant to help us do that, restore consciousness to its original pure state. And here I'm not talking about the more external forms of religion, which can be such a source of conflict.
Absolutely.
As we see in our world today.
They really can convolute everything.
I know, but I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about spiritual technology. Just like a geologist could tell us how to extract the pure element gold from its ore, where it may be mixed with less valuable elements. Now, once you've got the gold, you could form it into coins, and you could stamp the coins with the symbols of different nations. But if it's really gold, it doesn't matter what symbol you've stamped on it. And I think it's the same with these spiritual practices. If you're actually able to extract the pure element of consciousness or spirit from its covering elements, then I think it doesn't matter what you label it. You could call it Hinduism or Judaism or Christianity or Islam or Native American or Australian Aboriginal. It doesn't matter what label you put on it. If you're actually able to come to that platform where you see, I am a spiritual being, everyone else is also a spiritual being, we're all from the same source. You know, there's no reason for any of us to be fighting over matter. You know, I mean, I think it's the fundamental problem that we face in this world today, that you've got two kinds of people. You've got one type of person who is striving to realize the self within and its connection with the source of all conscious beings, and being able to recognize every other human being, not just even every other human being, but every other living thing.
And I would say most of those are listening to this program today.
I would think so, and I think it's very fortunate. But then there's the other kind of person that wants to focus not on the commonalities, but on the divisions. And we can see what they're prepared to do on the basis of those perceived differences,
mm-hmm.
and, and division. So I think we've each got to decide, you know, where we're going to put ourselves.
When you wrote the book Forbidden Archaeology, and there are some incredible things in there that would make one think that humankind has been around for a long, long time. Was there anything that was the most compelling for you? Was it those small steel balls, for example, you were telling me about, Michael, that were found that looked like they had some kind of marking on it or something? Remember those little small steel balls?
Well, those are from South Africa. There are some miners there have found these very interesting round metallic objects. I call them metallic because they're made of hematite, which is a naturally occurring type of iron. And what's the most interesting feature of these objects is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each of them.
Yeah, each one of them has that groove.
Well, something one groove or two or three or four, but most of them have several, and they're parallel, and they go all the way around. Now, some skeptics will say, well, you know, it could be possible that these you know, round objects could have formed naturally, but then somebody took them out of the ground and made these grooves on them. But, you know, I've been to South Africa. I visited the chief mining engineer from the mine where these objects come from, and he showed me like a solid block of rock, a solid block of stone with many of these round hematite objects solidly embedded in the stone with the grooves. You can see the grooves on the part that extended out of the stone. Like, you know, some of the round objects were kind of partially sticking out of the stone.
And how big were they, Michael?
But they're about 1 or 2 inches in diameter. They're different sizes. They're not big like basketballs or small.
But they're not little BBs.
No, they're not like little BBs either. They're medium size, 1 or 2 inches in diameter. And the ones that were partially sticking out of the stone, they also had the grooves going all the way back around into the solid stone. So you can't say that, well, you know, somebody just took these things and engraved these marks on them. You know, although those are very interesting, and to me they were very interesting because they're found in layers of solid rock about, you know, 2 billion years old. To me, they're very interesting until somebody can come up with some convincing naturalistic explanation how those things could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth. I think we have to consider the possibility that they were made by someone with human-like intelligence. Now, people have had a lot of different theories, to explain them. Some explain them as maybe perhaps having been left by time travelers, and others propose some kind of extraterrestrial explanation. And I favor the idea that they were made by some kind of beings with human-like intelligence that were existing on Earth in those very ancient times. But what's been more fascinating to me is not any one particular case, but to me what was most fascinating was the sheer number of cases. You know, when I first started this research back in 1984, you know, it took me 8 years to do the research for this book, but I didn't think it was going to take 8 years. I thought, well, I'll do 8 weeks of research. I'll find some interesting cases. I'll write a little article or maybe a small pamphlet about it, and then I'll go on to something else. But when I actually started looking into it, when I actually started looking into the original archaeological reports, not what you find in the textbooks, but going back to the original archaeological reports over the past 150 years in all the different languages, German, French, Spanish, Italian, English, Russian, when I started looking at those original archaeological reports, I found one case after another of this evidence for extreme human antiquity. And it added up to hundreds of cases. You know, the 8 weeks of research turned into 8 months. The 8 months turned into 8 years because one case just led to another. And to me, that was the most astonishing thing. Not that there were one or two striking cases, but that there were literally hundreds of these cases that weren't being mentioned in the textbooks, although they are there in the original scientific literature.
There's a moon of Saturn that looks much like those metal balls we were just talking about.
Somebody sent me a picture of that.
Yeah, it's Iapetus is the name of the moon.
Right, Iapetus. Right. Somebody sent me a picture of
the ridge that goes around the equator is 60,000 feet high, but it's on. You really could look at your materials that you were just talking about and this moon, and they look almost the same. It's weird.
Yes, it is. Maybe there's some kind of connection there. People have offered some different kinds of suggestions. Maybe these things are game pieces. Maybe they could be models of
spent fuel of a craft, maybe.
That's a possibility, or models of different objects in the solar system.
Well, I don't know. It is bizarre. Now, but of everything that you uncovered in forbidden archaeology, what's the one that baffled you the most, the one that really got you interested? Was it these metal balls, these iron balls? What?
Well, the case that I always found most fascinating, maybe it's because I live in California, is the California gold mine discoveries. I mean, that's what I found to be very, very, interesting, because, the miners, they came to California during the gold rush days, and they went to the Sierra Nevada mountains, and they were digging for gold. And to get the gold, they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains, like Table Mountain, which is near Sonora in Tuolumne County in central California.
Right.
And deep inside these tunnels, maybe 1,000 or more feet inside in the solid rock, they were finding human skeletons, human artifacts, and it was just amazing. And what I found really amazing is that these discoveries were reported by the chief government geologist of California, a man named Dr. J.D. Whitney, and he wrote a huge report about them that was published, by Harvard University, which is the most famous university in the United States. And despite that, these things just were not mentioned in the textbooks.
Why?
And it was because of this process of knowledge filtration. There was another scientist who was living at the same time as Whitney. His name was William Holmes, and he was an anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. And what he said was, and he was a more prominent scientist than Whitney in the scientific establishment in the United States, so his pronouncements were considered authoritative. So what he said was, if this Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, then he wouldn't have announced those discoveries despite the imposing array of testimony with which he was confronted, because he had cases from all over the gold mining region, not just one place. So I thought that was just really fascinating, because it showed that the reason why these discoveries were put aside was simply because they contradicted the theory of evolution. And it was directly stated by the scientist that this was the main reason why he was rejecting them. And I just found that to be just so amazing, that evidence can be rejected simply because it contradicts the theory of evolution. Now, what I found even more fascinating was that these objects, some of the discoveries, are still in the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. So a few years ago, there was a television producer named Bill Cote, who produced the first big film that he produced that was shown on television was about the Sphinx. He was the one who brought the work of John Anthony West
sure, who was just on the program.
And those people, who showed that the Sphinx was far older, than most scientists
right.
now believe. Then he got into this other topic, and he got in touch with me, and he said he would like to put some of the material from Forbidden Archaeology in his next NBC mm-hmm. television special, which was called The Mysterious Origins of Man. And I told him, well, one case you should probably try to, you probably should try to get some film on would be these California gold mine discoveries. So he went to that museum at the University of California at Berkeley, but they just refused to let him film the objects.
Why?
They gave him all kinds of excuses. First, they said, you're making a television program. You probably have a very tight deadline.
Yeah.
He told, I've got 6 months to do the show. Just, could we have a look, please? And then they said, we'd have to pay our workers overtime to do this. We don't have the money. So he said, I'll give them the money. But finally, they just said, no, go away.
That's amazing. Michael, stay with us. Back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What a fast night. Well, Lex and his able assistant, Sean, have been working around the clock to get you all set. Those of you who would like to play with Streamlink for free, get an idea what that is. This coming weekend, beginning Friday, you'll have a free 3-day Streamlink weekend. You're invited to test drive Streamlink, where it features MP3 downloads, live streaming, classic shows, and some other great features. Just have some fun. Just go to the coasttocoastam.com website, and you'll learn how to take advantage of the free Streamlink weekend. And welcome back with our guest, Michael Cremo, right here on Coast to Coast. Michael, why do you think mainstream science won't even open up the door to look at these possibilities, these theories, these things we've talked about tonight?
Well, it's not as simple as that because, mainstream science is not monolithic. There is a very influential, powerful group within mainstream science who wants to keep the door closed. That's absolutely true. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want others to hear what I have to say. Now, fortunately, even within mainstream science, there are some who are willing to listen to new ideas. And because of that, I've gotten a lot of invitations to some of the top scientific institutions in the world. I was invited by the Royal Institution in London to make a presentation about forbidden archaeology. I was invited by the Department of Anthropology, by the Russian Academy of Sciences. I've been invited by organizations such as the World Archaeological Congress and European Association of Archaeologists to present papers. So it's not that all of them are like that. However, some are, and they're very influential, and their voices are pretty loud, and they have a lot of influence in the scientific world. Why are they so resistant? I think there are a lot of reasons for it. I think one reason is it's just human nature. For example, if I love somebody, and then somebody tells me something bad about the person I love, at first I don't want to believe it.
You're in denial.
I may become angry at the person who tells me, and I think they're like that. They're very much in love with their current theories. They're very much in love with themselves, and if somebody says something that contradicts them or their theories, then they don't want to hear it. They become angry at the person who tells them, and I think that's one reason. I think there are deeper reasons that have to do with power, and it's amazing how this works, but there are different kinds of power in the world. There's military power, there's economic power, there's political power, there's also intellectual power, which is a very subtle power, but a very real one nevertheless, and here's how it works. The goals that we set for ourselves individually and collectively are to a large extent determined by the answers that we give to the fundamental questions, who am I and where did I come from? Now, through their monopoly, through their government-enforced monopoly in the education system, the evolutionists have had the power for the past 100 years to dictate to everyone else the answers to those fundamental questions, who am I and where did I come from? And they've been giving very materialistic answers to those questions. So they're telling us you're just a bunch of chemicals, you're an evolved ape, you're just another kind of animal. You're a purely material being, and that's all there is to it. And therefore, I think it's no surprise at all that our whole worldwide human civilization has become quite materialistic, so much so that most people think that the primary purpose of human existence is simply to produce and consume more and more material things.
Gosh, would you have been a great professor? I would have attended all your classes.
But the problem is that that process of material production and consumption generates huge amounts of wealth. Some of it goes into the pockets of the scientists who invent the weapons, the medicines, the drugs, the consumer products. More of the money goes into the pockets of the industrialists who manufacture the weapons, the drugs, the medicines, the consumer products. And some of it goes into the pockets of the government officials who tax all this economic activity. So there are powerful forces that would like to see this process go on uninterrupted. Because you notice, if economic activity, if the gross national product goes down even a percentage point, it causes shockwaves around the world. Just like after 9/11, people stopped buying. They stopped flying. They stopped purchasing. They just wanted to sit with their friends and relatives and think, well, what's going on with this world, which I think is a good thing to do. However, because of that drop in economic activity, it caused shockwaves all over the world. We're still suffering from it. The airlines haven't recovered. It's just amazing. So there are powerful interests in this world who would like to see us remain focused totally on this process of material production and consumption. And a key element of that is the scientists who are telling us we are just material beings, and therefore we should be just focusing on that. But what if we had a different set of answers to this fundamental question, who am I and where did we come from? What if in all the schools and universities and all the top scientific institutions, our educators and scientists were telling us, we are beings of pure consciousness, and we should be putting some of our human energy, more of our human energy, into developing the resources of consciousness and spirit, rather than totally focusing on this process of material production and consumption. That they don't want, because less human energy going into that process of material production and consumption means people are going to be less under the control.
That's right.
And that means that's going to be less money, less wealth and power, going to the people it's now going to. So I think that's the real reason. I mean, because, sometimes people think these questions like, what's the antiquity of the human species or whatever? What does it matter whether we think human beings have been around for a few thousand years or a few million years? I mean, aren't these just some sort of abstract intellectual questions for a few scientists or philosophers to argue about in their ivory towers? How does it affect us? But actually, the answers to these questions, who am I and where did I come from, they affect every one of us in a very, very deep way.
Michael, not only are you correct, you're right on, but it's a battle, and I'm not so sure we're going to be able to convince the right people. I mean, not to give up by any means, but I think they're going to fight it.
Well, absolutely, they will. They will fight it. But one thing that gives me hope is most people actually already agree with me. That's a very, very interesting fact. I mean, surveys have been done, Gallup surveys have been done in this country. Only about 10% of the people actually accept the standard theories of human origins, the evolution theory, we came from the apes theory, as the scientists are trying to teach it in the schools and the universities. Only about 10% of the American people actually accept that, which to me is a very positive thing. The same surveys show that, 50 to 60% of the American people, believe in different kinds of paranormal phenomena. They believe they've communicated with dead people. So most people are already on the right side of the question. However, the problem is that those who are supporting the other view, they have inserted themselves into the very influential and controlling positions in society. But I don't think that's something that can go on for a long time. Even even people that, even scientists, for example, who appear to be quite orthodox in their views, it's very interesting. A few years ago, I can't name this scientist, but he invited me to come and speak. He was a geologist. He invited me to come and speak at one of the major universities in one of the central states in the United States. Mm-hmm. And he invited me to speak to the entire geology department of the university, all the professors and graduate students of geology at that university. And I asked him, why did you invite me to do this? It seems very strange because he's a full professor. He's published textbooks, the scientific articles and all the big scientific publications, appears quite orthodox. I said, how did you learn about me and why did you invite me to come and speak about forbidden archaeology at your university? He says, well, I heard you on Coast to Coast. so you don't know who's listening.
Oh, we've got all kinds.
Yeah.
All kinds of we're going to take phone calls next hour, Mike. A lot of people have been sending me messages. They're just biting at the bit here to get to you, to ask you some things. What are you working on next?
Well, in the years since Forbidden Archaeology came out, I've gotten information about a whole lot more cases. So it's enough to make a new book. Of course, it takes me a long time. I'm calling the book Forbidden Archaeology 2 as a working title. It takes me a while to put these things together.
Because they're large books.
They're big books, and I have to do the research, because I have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's and things like that. But it's very interesting that some of the information that I'm getting is coming from listeners of your show and shows like yours. It's very, very interesting. For example, one listener wrote to me after hearing me on your show. I believe it was a couple of years ago. He wrote, you got a great book, and he was from Oregon. He said, here in the Waldo Mining District near O'Brien at the Easterly Mine, stone bowls and pestles were found in cemented ancient riverbed. They were so firmly cemented, the miners had to remove them with extreme care. Again, thank you for the great book. So I asked him, all right, I wrote back to him, and I said, okay, you told me about this case. Do you have any kind of documentation about it? So he sent me a newspaper article, a very interesting newspaper article from the year 1904 from the Rogue River Courier up there in Oregon. And the title of the article was Relics of Ancient Age, Mortars of Prehistoric Time Found in Weimer Brothers Mine. So the report gave very detailed information about the geological situation, where these artifacts were found. So they're found in old gravel of an ancient river channel, 50 or 60 feet below the surface, firmly embedded in the cemented gravel near the bedrock. So then from that information, I went to some scientific reports. I began looking at the scientific geological reports about that area to see if I could get any idea how old those particular layers where the human artifacts were found. And it turned out they're over 2 million years old. That's one of the cases that will be in this book that I'm working on now, Forbidden Archaeology 2, and I think it's very significant. It came to my attention through one of the listeners.
The Vedics that you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
They talked about flying machines. They talked about wars. Now, were you ever able to determine whether these flying machines were hours of the time, our kind of technology, human technology, or were they witnessing extraterrestrial visitations?
It appears they were of several different kinds, because as I mentioned before, it appears that we live in a multi-level cosmos. So there are very detailed descriptions of these aircraft and spacecraft. They're called Vimanas, given in these ancient Sanskrit writings. They're not like just some vague mentions. They're very detailed descriptions of them. Some of them were made of iron and metals like we're familiar with.
Sure.
And they came from other parts of our level of the cosmos. And so they're described. Some of those are described. And some of them come from this more subtle region, from the more subtle regions of the cosmos, and they have different kinds of abilities. Yeah, it's very strange. These, if you look carefully at the reports of the modern UFO phenomenon, you'll see that, well, some of them appear to be quite clunky machines, mm-hmm. but some of them, I mean, once I was giving a lecture on forbidden archaeology in Germany, and there was a pilot for one of the major American airlines that flies across the Atlantic. He had come to the lecture, and afterwards he was talking to me. And we got onto the topic of UFOs for some reason. And he told me how once he was flying across the Atlantic in a 747, he said, he saw coming directly towards him. He saw an object, you know, flying object coming directly towards him.
I was scared the heck out of him.
And it was closing at just this fantastic rate of speed. And he said, just before it hit the plane, it just went straight up.
Oh.
You know, just straight up.
Did he see detail on it?
And he said, like, he told me, he said, but we never report stuff like this because the second that you're supposed to report it, but he said, if you report it, then your career is pretty much finished. You know, you'll be investigated. You'll. So the point being that the modern reports of some of these UFOs show that they fly, they conduct themselves in ways that no plane made out of, you know, metal, you know, could possibly endure the G forces. You know, you can't do a 90-degree, you know, straight up turn like that at that rate of speed. The plane would just disintegrate.
Those are great stories,
you
Michael.
So I think that, as I said, a lot of the there's one group of the modern UFO alien abduction type researchers that see that the phenomenon sort of shades more into the mystical, paranormal, spiritual type of area. So I think these ancient Sanskrit writings, they describe both kinds of things. They described some of these craft as being made of ordinary metals and things like that, but others are being more composed of more subtle energies and operating on a different level.
God, that's incredible stuff. Can you imagine being in a plane, seeing that coming at you? And I'm sure you had a co-pilot, right?
Yeah, he didn't talk about what his co-pilot said.
But, that was a expletive deleted, right?
But there's just so much reporting on these things. Just a few weeks ago, I was giving a talk about forbidden archaeology at a conference called the Forbidden Knowledge Conference. It was held in Stoke-on-Trent in England. Mm-hmm. And of course, yeah, if you're going to have a forbidden knowledge conference, you got to have the forbidden archaeologist come.
And he's got to have you.
But,
that's right.
Sure. But for me, a lot of times when I go to these conferences, the most interesting thing or most pleasant thing for me is to meet some of the other researchers. So I met Nick Pope, who was until a few years ago, he was with the British Defense Department. He was in the department that dealt with UFO reports. And, you know, he was, you know, just, you know, confirming that, yeah, these things are there. I mean, it's really amazing. So you have reports coming not just from crackpot people. You've got, you know, people who are officials and the military establishment reporting that these things are definitely out there.
I think more and more of these reports, Michael, are coming from good, solid witnesses.
Yeah.
I really do. But again, back to the Vedics real quickly before the top of the hour. UFOs or ours? What do you think?
I think they were coming. Most of the ones that are reported in these ancient Sanskrit writings, the Vedas, are from other parts of the cosmos. They're not ours.
Ah, okay. So they were witnesses to these events.
Yes.
That's fascinating all by itself. Stay with us with our special guest, Michael Cremo. I'll tell you what, let's open up the phone lines. So when we come back, it'll be your turn to ask him a question or two about some of the things we've talked about. We'll also have him tell you about this incredible story about the dinosaur prince and the human prince. That's a great story. Back in a moment with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM.